Hey there, it's Virginia. Listen, NHBR, word of mouth included, is supported by you, our listeners, to the tune of 40% of our annual revenue. It's what makes us what we are, and you can help. The support button is at the top of the page at nhpr.org.
Word of mouth!
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Author, essayist, and staff writer for The New Yorker, Susan Orlean, takes vivid snapshots of people who live way off the beaten path. From the crowds attending the World Taxidermy Convention in Springfield, Illinois, to the obscure New Hampshire band, The Shags, she finds what is remarkable about ordinary-seeming people. Take her article about a man charged with stealing orchids in a Florida swamp. That evolved into the best-selling book, The Orchid Thief, which sort of turned into the movie adaptation in which she was played by Meryl Streep. Susan Orlean's newest book is a biography of one of the most famous actors of the 1920s, the German shepherd named Rin Tin Tin. Rin Tin Tin, the life and the legend, is now out in paperback, and Susan Orlean will be in New Hampshire tomorrow night for the Writers and the Loft series. Susan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be with you, Virginia.
Well, what a welcome. We've put you on hold, a captive audience to our pledge drive.
I know, but I was very persuaded.
Well, glad to hear it. So just how famous was Rin Tin Tin?
He was, I think, arguably the most famous dog in popular culture ever. What was surprising to me is I was very familiar with his fame in the 50s because I grew up at the very tail end of his television career, which was huge. What I didn't realize was that the original Rin Tin Tin had been an almost bigger star in the 1920s. He made 27 silent films, and they were, each and every one, a huge success, not only in this country, but around the world. He was arguably the biggest star in Hollywood in the 20s.
Well, we just heard a little bit of the theme from the series in the 50s on television, but let's go back to that day. You know, he was given the keys to New York City. He was nominated as Best Actor for the first Academy Award.
He was greeted when he toured around, when his films were opening. In almost every city, the mayor would meet him, and people would throng to see him. He was a matinee idol. And I think his fame was even, in certain ways, more universal than any of the human stars of that period, because he was beloved by adults, by children, by everybody who loved dogs. And he also was truly heroic. His personality was that of the loyal, brave, indomitable superhero in a way. And people were just completely enthralled by him.
This story is so rich, and there are so many, as in your a lot of your writing, so many different facets, a lot of great details. But one of the things that really spoke to me here was the story of Lee Duncan, the man who actually found Rin Tin Tin. Can you give us a little bit of that origin story?
Lee was a young man born in California at the end of the 1890s. He was a pretty solitary kid. In fact, for several years and during his childhood, he and his sister were put in an orphanage because his father had abandoned the family and his mother simply couldn't take care of the children. He came out of that experience, even though he had a sister and his mother ended up taking the children back. He believed himself to be essentially an orphan, and he never really formed very deep relationships with other people. What he found his solace in was in animals. He enlisted in World War I and found himself in one of the most, brutal, bloody battlefields, which was the sort of center of France during that time, which was a really pretty horrible time in the war. In the middle of this you know, grim, grim experience. He had been sent to examine a field that the Allies had just reclaimed from the Germans. He found there a dog kennel that had been bombed during the war. And I should make an aside here to say that there were tens of thousands of dogs used in World War One, and these were German war dogs. He went into the kennel. Most of the dogs were dead. But at the back of the kennel, he found a female who was still alive and who had just given birth to a litter of puppies. He scooped up the puppies and the mother, brought them back to his barrack, and he felt, and he repeated this through his life, that this was the moment when his whole life changed. And he was right. Not only did this dog, Rin-Tin-Tin, who was one of those puppies, become his dearest companion, but ultimately became his entire lifetime career as well. They came back to Hollywood. After the dog began to excel in dog shows, Lee had this crazy idea that maybe he could get him into Hollywood. He went walking up and down Sunset Boulevard, knocking on doors, and eventually got his way into a movie where Rin-Tin-Tin played the part of a wolf. And he did such a good job that Warner Brothers then decided to give him a contract and make him a star. And he was instantly a star. His first film just shot off like a rocket, as Jack Warner said. And every film from that point forward was a huge success.
I went back, inspired by the book, and watched some clips of Rin-Tin-Tin on YouTube, the original Rin-Tin-Tin. I'm remembering scenes of him, you know, like rescuing little pups from a cave in a burning forest. Mm-hmm. And the big question underlying the book is, what really was the appeal of this dog? And I'll leave that larger exploration to your discussion at the loft. But what do you see when you're just looking at this footage, Susan?
Well, the one thing that it sounds funny to say, but he was charismatic. He had star power. He was a really good actor. There's a scene in Clash of the Wolves where he's contemplating suicide, and it's extraordinary. You cannot believe that a dog can convey that kind of emotion. At the time that he became a star, 80 other German Shepherds were starring in silent films. So something about his ability on camera really worked, because here we are today, almost 100 years later, talking about him and not about Lightning and Thunderbolt and all the other dogs that were in films. He was also a great athlete. He had the advantage, too, of having some of the better writers in Hollywood, including Daryl Zanuck, writing the screenplays for his film.
It's amazing. Susan Orlean is the author of several books and articles. She's been a travel writer, staff writer for The New Yorker. She's going to be talking about her work and her most recent book, a biography of Rin-Tin-Tin, at Writers in the Loft in Portsmouth tomorrow evening. Well, there's so much that, of course, you want to save for that conversation, but one of the most interesting little tidbits I got, that he was, you know, Rin-Tin-Tin, this number one box office performer during the 20s, but like Douglas Fairbanks, his stardom did not transition to talkies. Why didn't he work in the talkie era?
What happened was Warner Brothers sent Lee Duncan, his owner, a letter saying that they had, in spite of Rin-Tin-Tin's extraordinary stardom, the company was going to focus on talking pictures, and as they said in the letter, everyone knows dogs can't talk. And this was, it's true, dogs can't talk. So Warner Brothers just assumed that the era of dogs starring in films was going to pass once talkies came into vogue, and they were largely correct. I mean, the phenomenon of people talking in movies was a huge sensation. But Lee scrambled around and got a contract with a smaller company called Mascot Pictures and began making these serial films, which were certainly at a lower level than the big, flashy Hollywood movies that they had been making in the 20s. But Rin-Tin-Tin kind of hung in there, made serial films in the 30s. He also hit the vaudeville circuit, and he was a giant success in vaudeville. This dog could do it all. He even had a radio show.
He was
able to adapt to the times in a way that people like Douglas Fairbanks really didn't. And that was part of the advantage of being a dog and not a human.
This is just another one of those discoveries. I feel like I've been reading your work for a long time, and you brought us face to face with so many of the offbeat, often remarkable creativity of ordinary people, but without making fun of their eccentricities, you know, the strangeness of the story. There's nothing sort of patronizing about your interest. Have you always had that in your approach?
I think that it's also not only my approach as a writer, but it is kind of who I am. I'm really genuinely interested in the world as it presents itself. And I was very lucky to have parents who really encouraged us to explore, to look at other lives, to not think that the way we were and the life we led was the only way life was. So I kind of came into being a writer already very comfortable with that idea, which was, I'm curious about people, and I don't judge them particularly, even if what they're interested in is something that I find kind of strange or that I can't relate to. In fact, if anything, it makes me more interested because I want to know why is someone interested in this? I don't understand it. And that really drives me as a person and as a writer. It just that curiosity to see what the world really is all about.
I know we're happy to have you back in New England. I know you're no stranger to New England. You wrote for the Phoenix and for the Boston Globe for years. There's a collection of essays called Red Sox and Bluefish that you wrote. Just wondering, you know, pang of the Red Sox, pang of New England, because I understand that you've moved to the West Coast now.
Well, right, yes. I'm a bit of a vagabond. My husband and I are in Los Angeles right now, which is extremely different from living in New England, as you might imagine. I guess part of the pleasure of having moved around a little bit is it all feels like an adventure to me. I'm here having a huge pang as I see the autumn colors, because one thing you don't get at all in California is autumn. On the other hand, in February, when flowers are blooming in my backyard in Los Angeles, I'm also pretty happy about that.
Well, Susan, I'm so glad that you could join us today, and I really think you'll have a great time tomorrow at the Portsmouth Loft.
Thanks, Virginia. It's so great to talk to you.
So great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
Susan Orlean is staff writer for The New Yorker, and she's author of several books, including The Orchid Thief and Red Sox and Bluefish. She's going to be at the Writers in the Loft tomorrow night to talk about many of her stories, but her most recent book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, which is now out in paperback. There is more on the event, the book, and all of her work at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find links or follow us or post your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter.